Hello, and welcome to this brand new podcast series brought to you by The Open UK. I'm your host, Matt Yakovit. I hope you'll join myself and Open UK CEO Amanda Brock as we celebrate the launch of the brand new book, Open Source Law, Policy, and Practice. Amanda was the editor of the book and brought together 24 experts in the open source software, hardware, and data space to share best practices, procedures, and laws. This book is being published by the Oxford University Press and is graciously being offered for free via non-commercial open access from the Beach Foundation. To buy or download a copy of the book, visit amandabrock.com/books for more information. We hope you'll join us as we bring in a new author every week to get key points, ideas, and advice from their specific chapters. We hope you are as excited for this series as we are, and we hope you'll like, subscribe, and share this podcast with your friends. Enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast. Today, we are again talking about the Open Source Law, Policy, and Practice book. We are going to be going through all the chapters in the book. We are, of course, joined by the editor, Amanda Brock.
Nice to be here.
Yes, nice to see you again. And today, we are joined by Kate Stewart.
Thank you. Nice to be here as well.
So, Kate, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So, my background is mostly as development management and product management. And I had a problem of trying to convey licensing information so that I could use open source. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, about 12 years ago, actually. And have been involved with trying to bridge between the legal community and the developer community through that period of time. And right now I'm at the Linux Foundation, and I'm focusing on embedded.
Oh, embedded Linux, like embedded systems?
Embedded systems, and that's where I was starting from as well, because you had to share this information accurately on the embedded side. And we knew BOMs. Bill of materials have been around forever down there, right?
Yeah.
You send out your box, you've got your BOM in there, right? And so the software obviously is just an obvious concept there too. So figuring out how we could share that efficiently and effectively has been a bit of a passion point of mine, because I spent way too many weekends one year, grepping through code bases to try to figure out what I needed to do in order to comply with the licenses, and decided there had to be a better way, and found some colleagues that also felt that there had to be a better way. So that's kind of where we sort of started working with SPDX, and SPDX stands for Software Package Data Exchange. So fairly right. And it's just an SBOM format. However, it is also an ISO format. We just finished taking it through ISO.
Congratulations. And yes. I should also declare that Kate and I have known each other a very long time. And we both worked together at Canonical over a decade ago. Yeah. Kate was the release manager. And I was somebody who was required by customers when we were doing support contracts and other contracts to put together a document in their format. Mm-hmm. It could be called all sorts of different things, an SOW, sometimes it was called a certificate of originality, all sorts of different names. But effectively, even back then, it was an SBOM, right?
Yep, it was an SBOM. And the challenge was, you know, no one wanted to do the big lift to get there.
So when you talk software bill of materials, so the SBOM.
Yep.
So what exactly is included? Like, what does that look like? Is it just like, you know, a big list of packages or?
No, that usually gets called a manifest file.
Okay.
What it means is, and there's been groups working in, you know, for the last few years to come up with a definition. In fact, the Department of Commerce was actually tasked with coming up with a definition.
Oh.
Via the executive order, and they came out with their minimum definition. And it's basically components, and a component could be things like packages or files, you know, and then relationships between them.
Okay.
And they just define a very simple relationship. But what you're trying to do is map out your graph of what depends on what. And so you can sort of follow and understand what might impact you. They were coming at more from the security perspective, but this information is already there. From a licensing perspective as well. We need it for both purposes. So understanding what's there, making it transparent, making it available, that's kind of what people want to see these days. And that's kind of what we started working on many years ago.
Okay. Well, so in this chapter, maybe tell us a little bit about some of the topics that you cover, like besides just the overall, you know, SBOM, SPDX.
Well, in this chapter, what I was really covering was breaking down what is all in SPDX and giving context to why it's okay. there. And then we talked a bit about sort of the emerging landscape in this space, and, you know, sort of why you want to have some of it in there, because you need to convey this information. And obviously, from a licensing perspective, it's very useful to know that something is statically or dynamically linked, things like that.
Yes. So, you know, one of the things, though, is some of these packages that are out there now have so many dependencies. They have so much software. This could get probably pretty big, right?
Yes.
Is there a practical side or a practical guide on how to, like, go through one of these SBOMs and figure out, like, what is actually important and what isn't?
So this is where we have a challenge.
Okay.
This is why we need it all automated.
Ah, yes.
We need to basically, because you don't know where your vulnerability is going to pop up 20 levels down.
Right.
On your dependency trees.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so what you need to do is have something that's machine readable, be able to ingest it, and then start to monitor it. You know, monitor your vulnerabilities of what you depend on and have an awareness of it so that you don't get, you know, the Log4Shell shell, or you don't get the next OpenSSL log. These are all, you know, vulnerabilities are found every day, and that's not going to go away because people, you know, are creative. And so we need to be able to have a roadmap for the defenders to understand whether they might be vulnerable or not.
And you mentioned that this extends beyond just security, because security has been kind of the driver, like you mentioned, you know, Log4j, mentioned some of the others. What are some of the other use cases that people are using these for?
Well, they're using it obviously to understand what their compliance obligations are and the licensing. And so that's where, this is where it's all, you know, this is where it came from in some ways. But we're also starting to look at using it for the same level of information we're going to be needing for proper safety analysis.
Oh.
And for being able to, you know, adhere to some of the safety standards that are emerging. Well, they're already, but they all call for this type of information. Yeah, I want to know, you can't say something is safe unless you actually know all the information there. So there's things we're working on for extending some of these cases for, like, in the robotics, all, you know, into, and it's actually going towards the AI side right now.
Mm.
So we've got a lot of autonomous type of cars, robots, so forth, and smart devices. And being able to figure out how we can catch the data sets is something we're sort of working on in the community right now, so that we can add that in and be able to take that in with the next rev of the specification. Because, you know, if you're running an autonomous car, understanding how it's been trained, how it's been used, whether it's going to be reproducible or not is going to be one of those factors you're going to care about down the road.
I think when you're looking at this area, understanding that the open source software is distributed with an exclusion of liability, that the developers, the companies that distribute it, unless you change that with a contract and payment, the law follows that the developers are not responsible for the use case, right? So if you're a user and you choose to take open source into your organization, private or public sector, you're taking on the responsibility for the implementation, for the maintenance, for the security, for the whole shebang of curation, as it's becoming called. And I think just picking up what Kate's saying there, if you're putting it into a use case that requires safety, you know, a safety critical use case, or something that requires security, or a regulated sector like telco or finance
or energy.
Or even bigger, you know, when you get into that, not just energy, but our digital public infrastructure, our national infrastructure, and our national critical infrastructure, it is the user. So the governments, the public sector, the enterprises who have to understand that. And you're not going to understand how you meet regulation if you don't know what you've got in there.
Right.
But it can't also be the Holy Grail, right? There has to be more than just SBOMs and supply chain management to meet those standards, to meet that curation. But I think it's quite a good starting point.
It's a starting point. It's very much, and, you know, the minimum viable that they sort of defined is a starting point. Like, the various formats like SPDX can cover a lot more information, and there's more things going in that are beyond minimum viable. So it's just a question of what's useful for each use case.
So does, you know, the current definition of SBOM include, like, package origins or patch origins, and go down to that level where you can have more verified, vetted, you know, contributions?
Yeah. So right now what it does have in there is service supplier concept in general, the minimum. On the other hand, like in SPDX, we have, you know, far more richness of a vocabulary to express these types of relationships. We've got a lot more richness of relationships we can express with the things. And so you can sort of understand how things relate to each other and whether you have a, like, it's quite, you know, if you're using a build tool to make something, you've got build dependency on that. That's quite different than a runtime dependency because, yeah. You know, and they both have, you know, significant implications in the supply right. chain, but at what you're shipping and what is going to be very much focused on how it all fits together. And we need that transparency for some of these, you know, use case analysis.
Because I think, you know, like there's a couple, there's a couple different use cases that, you know, kind of rattle around and they're based on those examples that are out there in the wild. So, you know, we mentioned Log4j, for instance, that's an easy one to kind of think because it was so impactful and it was like, people didn't even know that they had it in there.
Correct.
But then on the same token, you have people who are quote unquote bad actors or they're either producing malicious or buggy code that makes it into packages that generally are considered relatively clean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at the, what was it, the University of Minnesota tried to some...
You went to the kernel, yeah.
Into the Linux kernel, they tried to push some code. You look at, you know, protestware kind of on the rise, where, you know, you have packages that are dependent on packages, and you don't even know necessarily where some of the underlying code pinning. So, you know, while you're saying like, oh, this is from Red Hat, we'll say, because they're down the street. It's from them, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all the code was from them. It could be from thousands of contributors worldwide. And how do you trace that back?
And so this is why the component level is not sufficient. And this is why SPDX goes down to the source file level or even quite frankly to the snippet level.
Oh,
okay. Because licensing issues happen at the snippet levels, vulnerability issues. Oh, I've caught this over, these couple lines over from Stack Overflow and I've copied them into a code and I've recognized that pattern's there. That's a vulnerable pattern. Oh, I might want to track it down or, oh, that's got different licensing up there than it has in the file. So both are valid use cases and they're reasons why you need to have the snippet. And you need to be able to have the traceability back down to that level. So like one of the things we've done in one of the embedded projects I work on is you basically can generate out your SPDX documents. And what you can do is generate your source documents for your application and the operating system. This is for Zephyr project, by the way. And then you generate a build SBOM as well that links back the actual .os to those .c files. And then those .o files that made it into the .a for the libraries. And then the libraries that made the final ELF image. And so from that ELF image, you have a set of metadata that lets you track your way back through appropriate relationships all the way to your source files so that when someone may have corrupted things from somewhere maliciously in the corner, you actually could identify it and reflect it back saying, yes, this binary might be affected.
Yeah, I mean, and that's interesting. And so beyond that kind of level of detail that you're looking at, what other things do you think are coming down the pipeline in the future regarding this?
Oh, well, in the embedded space in particular, we're seeing a lot of the infrastructure and smart sensors happening, things like that. And that has a different life cycle than we're used to. When something's out in the field for 10 years, you may need to reproduce the building on it at some point in time. And so reproducible builds is useful for security as well as for these long life cycle type of devices. So I'm seeing that become a pretty common trend, that we're seeing that type of thing emerge and people it's starting to become concerned on how to support that. So like there's a civil infrastructure project, again, critical infrastructure and figuring out, okay, what do we need to do to keep it so that we have the Linux kernel, some of the software available. And if there's a vulnerability determined, you know, 10 years down the road, can you actually remediate or, you know, can you keep it in support?
Oh, okay.
Because I'm sure you're not using the same laptop right now than you're using 10 years ago.
I'm not using this. I've had probably 24 laptops in the last 10
years. Yeah, you see, I'm tight. I just got rid of my 2013 MacBook Pro, and I had two of them. One was a refurb, and one was my original.
I know, because you were locked into that model.
But I really liked it. You could drop it. You could kick it.
You could drop and kick the laptops that you had 30 years ago too, where they were like, you know, came in suitcases, you know, metal suitcases. Doesn't mean I'd want to use one today. Let's be honest. You know, and so Amanda, why do you think that, you know, like from the future of where this is going. You know, you mentioned like critical infrastructure. You mentioned, you know, how, oh, we're getting some sirens.
Speaking of
this
critical
is because
infrastructure.
You're talking critical infrastructure. Critical infrastructure. Are those sirens open source? That's what I want to know.
We are not adding sound effects to this. This is literally happening as we
live
go.
Live from Raleigh, North Carolina.
That's right. That's right. Here we are. We're live from Raleigh, North Carolina. You never know what's going to happen, right?
Apparently.
Never, ever, ever. So, Amanda, from an SBOM perspective, you know, where do you see this evolving? You know, Kate was mentioning, you know, some of the places that she sees, you know, kind of the next steps. I'm curious where you see, especially from a government perspective.
Yeah, I find it interesting. There's a sort of magnification of open source that's happened because people don't understand it. So from a risk perspective, they've put burdens on the open source community, the open source governance and legal community that they haven't put elsewhere. So if you're an open source company, you've been under scrutiny for the last decade. People want to know what's in there and don't trust you. Whereas nobody knows what's behind that proprietary black box. And it's not just about software. There is this big picture of our supply chain that the pandemic has highlighted for the first time where we don't really know. Sometimes we can go one or two generations into it, but when we get beyond that, we don't know what our supply chain is, full stop. And I suspect that we're going to be ahead of the curve in open source because of this added scrutiny, and that we're going to see supply chain becoming a really big issue across our lives and across our public sectors.
Yeah. One of the things that's kind of interesting in the SPDX project right now is we have Intel, we have ARM, and we have the RISC-V Foundation as members of the project.
Oh.
So the fact that we have a lot of hardware, and a lot of the hardware is going into things that are potentially programmed on FPGAs, et cetera, getting that transparency there is probably a direction where we, you know, we're starting to evolve into the system view more than just the software view. So from the data sets, from the hardware, from the software, these are all areas that we need the transparency. Therefore, we need to have some way of summarizing it.
Yeah. So I know this has been a book that has long been in the works. I mean, this is, you know, a long time coming.
I wouldn't go there.
Yes. We have to poke Amanda and make fun of her at least once a podcast. This took so long. And it was a labor of love. What?
You can't see the horror in my face. That sounds like you're criticizing me for
I'm
taking 5 years
of
my life.
It's a long process. It's difficult to get 25 people, you know, to contribute on all of these really critical topics. But at the same time, because of the length of time, things have changed.
Yeah.
And so what would you put into the book or the chapter that you wrote that you didn't get in there? Is there something that might be missed? Like, you know, like that you...
Well, I think the things that are missed are the things that are still coming, because Amanda was very good about giving us a chance to revise ourselves pretty much this last year. In fact, like I say, when we started this all off, ISO was not even on the, you know, it wasn't even a twinkle. And that took over a year to get through. And she made the point of making sure we had a chance to say, that's an important thing. Let's put it in.
Amanda was very good, otherwise known as Amanda was very foolish and took on extra work that she should have said no to.
Wow, you're not bitter, are you?
Just a little bit. Just around the edges.
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
It's okay. We'll give you a virtual hug. You know, there. You know, it's good. It's good.
I don't care. I'm going on holiday tomorrow.
Oh. Well, it must be nice. Mm. You know, yes. So there you go. So, Amanda, any final thoughts?
I think it's one of the most important emerging areas, and this is probably the first time anything's been written in a book about it. And I suspect it's something that if you follow Kate and others involved in this space, you're just going to see more and more good information around. And it is a critical topic for our sector, and understanding, you know, the burdens that it may or may not put on community and developers and individuals, and ensuring that we collectively and collaboratively understand that and protect, I think is really important.
Mm-hmm. Kate, any final words to the audience?
Making it easy for developers is going to be the heart of actually getting it adopted.
Of course. It always is, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it needs to be in the background, and we need to be just doing it automatically and not even thinking hard about it. So it just needs to become part of the ecosystem. You ship a binary, you've got your SBOM with it. And then hopefully we'll start to get it a little bit more sane.
All right. Well, Kate, thank you. Thank you so much for hanging out with us today, talking to us a little bit about, you know, SBOMs, a little bit about the book, about your, you know, part in that. Amanda, as always, thank you.
No, thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Matt. Oh. Yes.
Too gracious. But for those who are listening, we're going to be doing this over the course of multiple weeks. We're going to try and hit every author in the book on a different open source topic. It's going to be great. So go ahead, subscribe to the channel, follow us on your favorite podcast app. We really appreciate it. Until next time, we'll see you later.